It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel. Let's talk about texting and driving. It's illegal, which you know because you never, ever do it. It's a $124 fine for a first offense if you get caught. Now, Washington State was a leader on this. We were the first state in the country to ban texting while driving a decade ago. And since then, phones have changed a lot, but our laws haven't. So state lawmakers are pushing for a change, and it might happen. Austin Jenkins is in Olympia covering the legislature for KUOW. Hi, Austin.
Good afternoon. How are you, Jeannie?
Good. So we haven't updated our laws to keep up with all the stuff phones do now. Why not?
Well, you know, there's many reasons. First off, it has not been for lack of trying on the part of lawmakers who are especially passionate about this issue. In fact, you may remember that it took former state Senator Tracy Eide a decade to convince her colleagues to pass the current law, which bans texting and driving while holding your phone up to your ear. So these things take time. I also think there's a bit of a libertarian streak to our politics here in Washington and at work on this issue. There's always the argument of, why are you singling out my cell phone use and not going after somebody who's eating their Big Mac or putting on eyeliner or reading a book? And then, you know, there's the nitty-gritty details of how do you write a law that can actually be understood by the public and enforced by the police. I will say that I think one thing that may have changed the equation this year is that there was very emotional testimony from victims and families of victims who were killed in terrible distracted driving crashes. And that is compelling to lawmakers when they hear those very personal, very emotional stories.
Hmm. Well, the House has already passed this distracted driving bill. So what would it do? How is it different?
Yeah, so both chambers have, and they really just need to reconcile a couple of minor differences, mainly having to do with the implementation date, which would be January 1 of 2019. So if this goes into law, people have time to adjust to it. But here's what it would do. It would replace the current law that's on the books. And in essence, it would say that no matter what the device is, if it's a personal electronic device, you cannot use your hands to operate that device while you are driving down the road. Not only that, at a stoplight or stuck in traffic on the freeway, you can't pick up your device and start using it. There would be an exception to using the term is minimal use of a finger to activate or deactivate a function. So you could press your iPhone button for a moment to activate Siri. That would be allowed. But you can't dial a phone number.
Hmm. Well, how do the penalties change if you get caught?
It doubles the penalty amount on the second violation. So second and subsequent offenses, it's a double penalty, which I think would be over $250. It also allows, if you get a ticket for this, it would allow your insurance company to be notified. And that would, of course, potentially affect your insurance rates.
You said that both chambers have passed this, but who opposed this?
There was actually a lot of opposition. And as I mentioned before, that sort of libertarian streak emerged a little bit. Well, you really heard two arguments. One was, again, why are we singling out cell phones? One of the lawmakers who's a police officer was saying, you know, he sees all manner of distractions behind the wheel, not just phones. Probably the most interesting opposition on the floor of the House this week was from Republican State Representative Ed Orcutt. He's the ranking Republican on the House Transportation Committee. And he argued that the crackdown just goes too far. And he said it might result in drivers who are actually not distracted, but using these devices from being ticketed. And he gave his quote was, you know, they're driving fine. They're at a normal speed. They're leaving a safe distance. They haven't swerved. And then they get pulled over. He says, I don't think they should be pulled over in that case. I think that they should have to do something to warrant getting pulled over besides having the device in their hand.
Well, how would this be enforced?
You know, that is tricky. It's easy to conceal what you're doing in the compartment of your car, right? The police officer, you know, driving down the road can see if you have your seatbelt on, harder to see if you're holding the phone down by your lap. I think what you hear from police officers is, for the most part, they're looking for blatant violations, i.e. I'm holding the phone to my ear, or they're looking for a car that is not paying attention, a driver who's not paying attention and swerving down the road. But, you know, this gives them, they would say, more opportunity to actually enforce reality out there, which is it's not just about texting and driving anymore. It's people Snapchatting, it's FaceTiming, it's streaming a Netflix show, you know, whatever. I mean, they've seen it all, but current law doesn't really apply to current technology.
I think this is actually worth clarifying. We're talking about drivers streaming Netflix, not, say, kids in the back seat watching Daniel Tiger or something.
still, your kids could still watch Daniel Tiger, but the driver cannot be streaming while they drive down the road. And you know, interestingly, there was an amendment that I think they accepted in the House that does exempt autonomous cars. At least that was a proposal. So there is some thought to how our driving might change in the future as cars get smarter and smarter, along with our phones, and they try to get us maybe into the back seat where we can't do as much trouble and damage. But for the moment, since we're still operating our vehicles, they're saying you should be doing that without the distraction of the device.
Well, Austin, now that this has passed both the House and the Senate, it's likely that Governor Inslee will sign it and it'll become our new law?
The assumption is that he will, and right now the Senate, as we speak, is doing concurrences, so this could come up at any moment, any day now, and then it'll be off to the governor. And I think, barring some surprise, this is likely to be going into effect. As I said, the actual effective date, though, isn't until January 1, 2019.
Well, Austin Jenkins, Olympia correspondent for KUOW, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And if you're out there driving right now and thinking, you know what, I'll put my phone away when the law goes into effect in 2019, you might want to rethink that. Police departments across the state have added patrols to stop distracted drivers during the first 2 weeks of April. Coming up, how far outside Seattle do you have to go and in which direction to find a full day of sunshine? We'll hear your answers in about 15 minutes on The Record. It's the wrong tax at the wrong time. That's what King County Council Budget Chair Dave Upthegrove said about a proposed sales tax to fund the arts in King County. The proposal was called Access for All, and it would have funded big arts organizations and even Woodland Park Zoo. Councilmember Upthegrove pulled the proposal the day before his committee was set to consider it. But Access for All isn't dead yet. KUOW's arts correspondent Marcy Silman, why did Councilmember Upthegrove decide to pull this proposal from consideration in the first place?
Well, Jeannie, Dave Upthegrove represents the Kent Valley area, which is home to many low-income residents in King County, and he feels like a sales tax is a regressive tax, which would disproportionately affect his constituency. That said, he is not really totally opposed to a tax for arts and culture. I think he wants the revenue to go fairly to more organizations and more community-based organizations in South King County, specifically organizations that are outside the big population centers of Bellevue and Seattle.
So Upthegrove pulled the bill from his committee's consideration, but then what happened?
Well, it was amazing. Arts and culture advocates organized via social media. What else? More than 100 supporters showed up yesterday morning at the budget committee, even though the measure wasn't supposed to be on the agenda. They demanded that they get a chance to voice their support for the culture tax, and Upthegrove let them speak. That said, the committee still didn't take any action.
Okay, so then if the committee didn't take any action, why is this bill still alive?
Aha. Late yesterday, three council members who do strongly support an arts and culture tax said that they were going to pull that bill themselves out of the budget committee and bring it to the full council for consideration. And according to some kind of technical rule, they do have the right to do this. Apparently, they only need a simple majority of the county council to agree to do that. If they do get that majority, and that is a big if, they still need to act by, I believe, Monday, April the 17th, to get the measure onto the August ballot. And even if it gets to the August ballot, of course, Jeannie, the voters have to approve taxes in a time where it seems like we're asked to tax ourselves for everything that exists.
Right. As you pointed out earlier, Marcy, Access for All is a sales tax. It would have been an extra penny for every $10 purchase. And we vote down taxes, not all the time, but often latte tax, other sales tax. So why didn't Upthegrove just let it go through, trusting that we wouldn't vote to tax ourselves again?
Such an interesting question. And you are not the first person to ask me that. In my conversation with Upthegrove late Tuesday, I got the sense that he truly feels like this proposal was just the wrong measure to put before voters when there are so many other competing needs in the county.
I was under the impression, Marcy, that the arts were pretty well funded here because we have philanthropists who are willing to give money to the arts. why is this tax even necessary?
I'm sure they're all laughing right now as they listen. Many of the most generous arts patrons are older, and big arts groups have been figuring out, or trying to figure out for years, what is the best way that they can entice younger people with means, specifically some of the tech money, to become arts patrons. It's a really complicated task. I had a conversation with the Seattle Foundation this week, and according to them, many of those potential donors are much more interested in giving to causes that have quantifiable outcomes. So buying 50 lunches for kids in need or building a sanitary center, you can count what happens. It's not necessarily the same thing as providing 30 kids in a low-income school with tickets to a theater production or a concert. That might have some kind of impact, but it's not as easy to measure.
Well, you had a conversation with the campaign manager for this tax proposal, Access for All. What did he tell you about the future of this proposal?
You can imagine, if you run campaigns like this, you have to put the best face on anything. I think you have to kind of be a Pollyanna. Jack Sorensen, the manager, says the measure is not dead yet. I think that he and his supporters are in the process of rallying county council members to their cause, to just get them to put it to a vote. As of last night, Jack Sorensen was confident still that this measure was going to be on the August ballot.
Well, as this proposal maybe possibly moves forward in the King County Council, what are you going to be watching?
Well, I'm really most curious to see how a sales tax will fare with voters. I haven't done a deep dive recently into this proposal. This has been in the works, actually, for several years. It was initially going to be a tri-county measure. Now it's a King County measure. It's a tough sell in a climate where social service spending is being slashed at the federal level. King County and Seattle have to pick up expenses they never planned on paying for. So, but if the voters want it, well, let's see.
Marcy Silman, KUOW's arts correspondent, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Trees are in bloom, and that means honeybees are back. For fruit growers in the Pacific Northwest, it's time for the annual struggle between keeping their trees alive and keeping bees alive to pollinate those trees. Reporting for EarthFix, Eilish O'Neill visited an apple orchard in western Washington to find out more.
We're looking overlooking the Bellwood Orchard. The first block that you see to your right is the first 10-acre block that was planted in 1996.
Dory Belisle and her husband John own the biggest apple orchard west of the Cascades. From the farmhouse, you can see piles of apple crates and rows of trees that stretch for acres.
Springtime's magical in the orchard. And the weird thing is, all these flowers on these trees, right, that are magically wonderful to our eyes, are designed to attract a whole other species.
You walk out there and there's bees everywhere. I mean, the orchard hums with their working.
But springtime in western Washington's wet weather also brings something a lot less magical than bees and blossoms. It brings fungi, like anthracnose.
It puts wounds on the trees, you might say, and takes away the circulation in the cambium, kills the tree. So we've had whole orchards go out up here in the northwest on the west side of the mountains. It likes moisture, so the other side of the mountains do not have that problem. It's just kind of us. You keep cutting it out, but eventually the tree disappears.
In the 1990s, Western Washington apple farmers nearly lost the battle to anthracnose. While apples were booming east of the Cascades, Western Washington lost hundreds of acres, 17% of its total apple acreage. Some counties lost all their apple trees. The farmers who survived, like the Belisles, had found a tool for fighting back: fungicides.
You can put fungicides on the trees that are there like birth control. So every week, we go out and we put a fungicide on, and that stays there. And then when the rains come and the pathogens are released from the leaves, they go up into the tree and they land on product that's protected and they can't reproduce.
But the fungicides that saved the trees could now be threatening the orchards, says May Barenbaum, a bee researcher at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.
It turns out that honeybees that ingest fungicides have trouble breaking down the phytochemicals in their natural food. So not only are chemicals themselves potentially toxic, but they can interfere with the ability of honeybees to extract the energy they need from the food they eat.
The problem is that regulations don't always reflect everything scientists have learned about bees. Historically, the EPA has only tested whether or not a chemical kills adult bees outright. It hasn't looked at how chemicals might weaken bees or affect larval bees. So a few years ago, the EPA revisited how it reviews pesticides.
Their new risk assessment process includes both acute and chronic effects.
Eric Johansson's with the Washington Department of Agriculture.
It also looks at effects not just on adult bees, but also on bees as they're developing. Any new active ingredients would go through that process every 15 years, give or take. They're going to relook at all existing active ingredients.
It's not that farmers are doing anything wrong. John Belisle with Bellwood Acres says they're just following the label.
The way we know whether it's toxic or not, the way we think we know, is that the label says you can spray it on bees, and the label says you can't. It might even say spray at night. You know, if there's bees in the orchard, spray at night.
But it could be another decade and a half before pesticide labels reflect the latest science. In Seattle, I'm Alicia O'Neill.
My name is Tom Donnelly, and I live in Urbana. And my question is, if you want to escape the winter blues, how far do you have to go? And where do you go? Do you go east or west? Don't want to go north. We know what's up there. But that was my curiosity in this.
That's a listener question from our local Wonder Project, and a pretty timely one considering how much rain we've gotten. How far and in what direction do you have to travel away from Seattle to get a full day of sunshine? We want to hear your answers to that question. Call us at 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-5869. And KUOW's Emily Fox, you've been trying to answer Tom Donnelly's question for him. Hi.
Hello. Yes. So, For Local Wonder, we have three questions. People vote. And I remember in the promo, this was the last question. I was like, I love this question.
Why?
Because every single morning, I have to put together the weather forecast. And like today, I said, there's a good chance of rain today. But all day, I've been looking out the window, and it's been pretty sunny. So I feel like I'm letting people down. Also, I am a sun seeker. I make daily decisions based on the weather. I have a personal weather app outside of giving people the weather forecast in the morning. I probably look at my phone weather app about 5 times a day. It tells me if I can take a run after work and not get poured on, if I need to wear my rain pants while biking to work that day. And then every single weekend, I have different plots around Washington State, you know, from eastern Washington to up to Bellingham, or maybe if I want to go down to Portland, to kind of figure out what's happening in the weather, and that will decide what I do each weekend. So like Tom, I totally want to know where these places are. Where do I need to go?
Well, and part of your curiosity means that you're actually here to ask for help. So what are you looking for?
So I want people to try to answer this question. There's so many ways to go about answering this. And so I'm so curious for you who's listening right now, how would you go about figuring this out? What do you think the answer is?
Call us with your answer, please. We're at 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-5869. Again, the question is, how far outside of Seattle do you have to go and in what direction to get a full day of sunshine? Emily, you've been asking listeners this question for a couple of days now. You've received a few comments on Facebook. So what has the response been?
So what I love to hear is people go, why are you even asking this question? We are in Seattle. You know we are in Seattle. You signed up for this. But we do have a lot of people talking about the Cascades and generally rain shadows, right? We have the Olympic rain shadow. So some people said, head to Port Townsend, head to Squim. And then you have the Cascade rain shadow. So they said, maybe Yakima. And so we had a comment specifically from Dave O'Hearn, and he said, head east to Ellensburg, then south to Yakima, then south to Goldendale until it's sunny to your satisfaction.
Wow.
And I loved that specific response. So we called up Dave to get a little more information. And he says he definitely likes the sun more.
I went to Wazoo because I was tired of all the rain in Seattle from growing up here. But I find now that I've graduated and I'm an adult, I find I'm more willing to tolerate winters of rain than I am with snow. So I don't mind Seattle so much anymore. But I still like sun better than rain.
So we wanted to talk with Dave because he shared this very interesting Washington Post article. It uses data from the Centers for Disease Control. They get that data from NASA. And so what NASA does is basically they take these satellites and track how much sun, and they track how much sun based on kilojoules of solar radiation. So now we're getting really nerdy with this answer.
Wow.
And there's a map of the United States. For every single county in the U.S., it tells you how many kilojoules of solar radiation. So as you can imagine, the farther north you go, the more blue the color is, meaning the less kilojoules of solar radiation. So they take into effect how far away you are from the equator, how much sun you get, how much air pollution is in the air. So basically they found that the lowest amount of kilojoules of solar radiation is in Island County here in Washington State. The most is in Imperial County, California, near Baja. So let's say Island County has about 13,000 kilojoules of solar radiation per square meter. Imperial County, California has about twice as much, and we're pretty close to Island County. Here in King County, we have 14,000 kilojoules of solar radiation per square meter. So we're getting really sciencey, really in the weeds with this. So there's so many different ways to ask this question and answer it.
And if you want to look at that interactive map that Emily is talking about, we're tweeting a link out to that now. So, okay, Island County gets just under 13,000 kilojoules of solar radiation. King County gets about 14,000 kilojoules. I don't know what that means, but we have someone here who does know what that means. State climatologist Nick Bond, hi.
Hey there.
What's a kilojoule of solar radiation?
Well, it's a unit of energy. And so it's what NASA is doing is basically summing up all that solar energy that's mostly in the visible part of the spectrum that's hitting in various spots across the U.S. And again, basing it on what they're seeing from satellites.
So is there any, am I going to notice a difference between 13,000 kilojoules of solar radiation and 14,000 kilojoules? Like if I go to Island County, am I going to think this is even darker than King County?
Well, you'll probably notice it. There's a lot of variability from day to day and even year to year. I have to give props to Dave, though, because he mentioned Goldendale. Klickitat County is the sunniest county in Washington State.
So that's one possible answer to this question of how far outside of Seattle you should go to get a full day of sunshine.
That being said, there's no guarantees. It's not like every day is completely sunny there. And so it kind of depends on the weather situation we're in. But still, your odds are better there.
We're asking this question how far you have to go outside of Seattle and in which direction to get a full day of sunshine. We've gotten answers from listeners. We'd love to hear from you as well at 206-543-5869. George in Olympia, where do you go?
I go east. I like to go over Snoqualmie Pass and go to Ellensburg.
Ellensburg. Okay. So how often are you headed there for your sunshine fix?
Oh, I probably go and fish the Yakima River. I try to go once a month, every other month.
I will say I looked at the weather forecast for Ellensburg this weekend because I was wondering if I could get out of town myself. There's not a lot of sun promised in Ellensburg this weekend. So do you have a backup plan?
Ooh, further east.
Further east?
Further east across the Columbia.
Okay, fair enough. George, thank you so much. So, Nick Bond, as long as we have you here, where do you go to get a sunshine fix?
Well, again, it's kind of weather dependent. And yeah, you use the mountains kind of for protection. And so it depends. There are times when the winds are from the southwest where Sequim, Port Townsend is a good bet. Other times, actually, the south side of the Olympics that are, really rainy at times can be okay. And so Shelton, among the cities in the Puget Sound area, gets a little bit more sun in the winter than some other spots.
Okay. I also know something about you, though, Nick Bond. I know that you're not necessarily a sun person. You're a rain person.
Well, yeah. I love the rain. And it's, again, like you mentioned earlier, if you live in the Seattle area, you got to expect some clouds. And it keeps our skin looking so smooth and youthful, right? You know, so it's all good.
We're asking the question how far you have to go outside of Seattle and in which direction to get a full sunny day. I'm talking with KUOW's Morning Edition host, Emily Fox, and state climatologist Nick Bond and Carl in Greenwood. Where do you go to get sunshine?
I love the areas in central and eastern Washington that don't have many trees growing. Trees are an indicator of precipitation. And there's a fascinating geological landform that we have in Washington, which is the largest catastrophic flood erosion event that ever occurred on the face of the earth. And you can start at Grand Coulee Dam, and there are other areas on a self-guided tour that you can see the results of catastrophic flooding caused by the failure of an ice dam that held Lake Missoula back. And anywhere from Grand Coulee Dam at Banks Lake in central Washington to Palouse Falls, which was created during a huge event that actually made the Snake River flow backwards. I've seen a lot of these sites, and it's absolutely fascinating. And you will get considerably more sun there than you do here.
So I'm so curious, what does that look like? I'm picturing like the Grand Canyon of Washington that no one knows about. What does it look like?
Different from that, although there are huge canyons, Banks Lake fills a large coulee, and downstream from there, the areas that were scoured out by the flooding continue down south to Soap Lake through some very, very beautiful canyon lands. But we first went out into central Washington in the mid-50s, very shortly after Banks Lake was filled. And what struck me as a young child was obvious uphill erosion. And here you had the volume, something like Lake Michigan, that was released over a period of just a very few days. And so what looked like uphill erosion was actually erosion scoured out at the bottom of this huge, fast-moving lake. The potholes were also carved out by eddies in the fast-moving water. And so it's not like the Grand Canyon, but it's very very appealing. And you can be driving along on areas that are just flat prairie land, and suddenly you're in an area that is beautiful canyons that wind around.
Carl, thank you so much. That's a really lovely description. I'm assuming it's also sunny in those places as well. But I wanted to call back to something that Carl in Greenwood said, which is that trees are a sign of precipitation. And if you're driving east on I-90, you can actually see where things switch to the sunny side of the state. There's a line where trees stop just past Clay Elum. Have you seen that, Nick Bond?
Oh, well, sure. And yeah, and so it's really marked that, and it has to do, again, what people are talking about, this shadowing by the terrain. And it's even more dramatic in terms of how it impacts the precipitation versus the cloudiness. And so it's sunnier in eastern Washington than here, but it's a lot drier.
I wanted to bring in another listener who called in with his response. This is Steve Winnie. He lives in Everett. He watches weather reports around the state, just waiting for the right conditions.
And the first time I see a place within driving distance of Everett where it's going to be 70 degrees for the weekend, I just go there. So I don't have a specific planned destination. Some years it's caused me to go to Pendleton, Oregon, or the Tri-Cities. I wound up over in Spokane, and I wound up all over the Northwest, anywhere within about 4 or 5 hours of driving time. It's been a lot of fun. I've seen a lot of places that I never would have seen if it hadn't been for that, and I really recommend it for everybody.
Emily Fox, you said earlier that you make daily, sometimes you make weekly or weekend plans based on whether it's sunny or not, but what do you think of Steve Winnie's planning? I mean, he's like a near constant lookout for regional sunny destinations.
This is my man. I am all for that. I mean, I do a very similar thing, probably not to the extent that he does, but for example, so I moved here almost a year ago. I moved here in April last year, and I remember May rolls around. I mean, we did have some of those hot, sunny days. May rolls around for the most part. June rolls around. I'm like, it is not going to get above 65 all summer long. Here I am unpacking all my clothes from the Midwest, which is like all about the extremes and being like, I'm not going to need this tank top anymore. I'm not going to need this crazy big fluffy sweater. And then, you know, I mean, in June, it was like, I want to feel that heat. And so after doing this kind of daily routine of looking at what the temperature is, what are, you know, where the sun is in the state, you know, on a weekly or daily basis, I realized that this spring in May, I'm going to start heading to Eastern Washington. I'm going to do a bike trip in Walla Walla while it's hot over there. I'm going to do a backpacking trip around Lake Chelan, you know, to feel that heat that we don't get here. And so this idea that he's going to seek out this first 70-degree weather, I'm all about it.
Now, Nick Bond, we only have about a minute left here, but I wanted to ask what you think of Steve Winney's strategy of that, I guess, near constant vigilance when it comes to using weather reports to make plans like this to seek out sun. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, he's spot on in that it is weather dependent where it's going to be sunny. And the east side is not always sunnier than here. And in the middle of winter, they can have some low clouds down the Columbia Basin. It can be really dreary weather there. The springtime, there is a pretty consistent signal there. But and then in the summertime, there's plenty of times where the west side is just fine, and we're better off being here where it's a little more temperate than you know, the heat in eastern Washington. So, but the idea, we're getting better at making forecasts days out of those kinds of conditions, and so you should be flexible, and you can probably find someplace you like.
Well, state climatologist Nick Bond and KUOW Morning Edition host Emily Fox, thank you both so much for coming in and talking about this.
It was a pleasure.
Yes, thank you.
And we are still looking for your answers to this question. How far outside of Seattle do you have to go to find a sunny day? What direction do you go in? Email us at record@kuow.org, tweet at us, we're at KUOW, or respond on KUOW's Facebook page. Thanks so much. This is The Record. I'm Jeannie Yandel. It's The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel.
The Secretary General and I had a productive discussion about what more NATO can do in the fight against terrorism. I complained about that a long time ago, and they made a change. And now they do fight terrorism. I said it was obsolete. It's no longer obsolete.
That was President Trump earlier this week changing his opinion of NATO. You might remember a lot of talk during the campaign from candidate Trump about how obsolete NATO is. He also changed his mind this week on whether or not China is a currency manipulator. The president says that's also no longer the case. It can be hard to keep up with the Trump White House. Tech entrepreneur Jan Miksovsky gets that. He's trying to help you keep track at a website he started called Presterity, as in press and posterity. Miksovsky told Deborah Wong starting the site was a reaction to the election of Donald Trump, but it was a little bit of a delayed reaction.
I think after the election, it was probably 3 weeks of just shock and, you know, despair. I really had no sense of what I could do. And, you know, I was concerned about the fear of information overload. And even just during the campaign, it was hard to keep up. So I was really concerned about, you know, what would happen when there were not just 20 bad things happening every day, but 200. And it was only around the end of November that I began trying to sort of shake off my despair and think about this as maybe a designer or a technologist would, which is be to, you know, that's my background. I've done that for 30 years. Like, what can I, as someone who tries to design solutions to problems, contribute? And so I began to think, is there a problem in here that I can help solve? And I decided to focus on that problem of information overload and documenting facts.
So tell me about the site and, mm-hmm. and what does it do?
So the site is created by volunteers as a way of documenting the events of the Trump administration and with a particular focus of news of concern. So we're trying to take when we see something go by in the daily news cycle that's alarming to us and we think is either something of historical importance or of particular concern to a group, then we flag it for inclusion in the site. And then we have a process by which people organize that information into a site that anybody can come come to and become informed.
So who is this website intended for?
The main audience we view the site for are people who are working on the front lines of resistance. So it could be advocacy groups, it could be watchdog organizations like the ACLU, it could be legislative staff in different state campaigns, and then citizen activist groups. So if someone's trying to understand a particular topic and wants to have essentially a dossier created for them on the topic, then they can go to the site and find everything about the Dakota Access Pipeline or Trump's misogyny, say. And so we look at ourselves as essentially a reference desk for the resistance. We have no big egos. We're happy to play a supporting role in this story to create this this resource that these other groups can use.
If it's mostly just aggregating mainstream media articles, though, I mean, how is it any different than going to Google and just searching Dakota Access Pipeline?
One of the challenges when you're trying to understand a particular topic is a basic challenge is understanding a sequence of events. So as a starting point, we create for each topic a timeline that makes it much easier for someone to see how the thinking on a particular topic has evolved or where something came from. And it helps to place other information in context. So if you're researching a particular story or a particular bill, you may have an article that you found through Google that's got a date on it, and you want to understand where did this fit in the timeline of events. Was this before Trump said that horrible thing or after he said the horrible thing? And so having a timeline to refer to really helps organize that that consideration of the topic. So that's a key thing, is to be able to have a picture of the whole story as it unfolds. And that's something that you can't get from Google or Wikipedia or some other site. So that's a key thing.
Do you expect the vast majority of the readers of this site will be people who are anti-Trump? I mean, you're not expecting any supporters of Trump to be visiting anytime soon?
No. You know, they've proven resistance to facts already, so I don't think we're going to be the ones to change their minds. I think that, you know, we welcome contributions and readership across the political spectrum. So I think to the extent that this is anti-Trump, many people will look at it as being liberal. I look at it really as anti-Trump and sort of anti-lying. So if you're a conservative and you're concerned about things that Trump is saying about interfering with the free market or free trade, then, you know, you should be able to come to the site and find news that's relevant to you. And we would welcome contributions from someone like that.
You said earlier that after the election, you were really shocked by the results. And I know there's been a lot of hand-wringing about how we've each been, you know, both sides of the political spectrum have been sort of encased in their own bubbles and not really understanding the other side. And I know you're not a journalist, so you'd have no obligation to fairness in this issue. But isn't a website like this sort of allowing people to become more encased in their bubbles rather than trying to get out of their bubbles?
I do, you know, struggle with the question of how do we avoid making the situation worse as we try and share our information? How do we do it in a way that is not targeted solely at people who are already living in a particular news bubble, but do that in a way that could be appealing to a broad range of people? But as you say, I'm not a journalist and I'm no, you know, media innovator here. So I think we just do our best job at focusing on facts and then hope that that will be enough.
So in the little summaries that you write, are you trying to keep a neutral tone or is it really written for people that you know share your political views?
I wouldn't say that they share our political views. I think that, you know, and there's a range of contributors to the site. Like, I wouldn't say that everyone who's contributing to the site shares a consistent political outlook. I think everyone who, you know, the main qualification to join the project is to be deeply skeptical of Trump and his administration. And that does create a sort of lens. We focus our attention, so to use those summaries as an example, when we're trying to summarize a topic, our interest is not in describing things that Trump has done that are positive on that topic. If that were to happen, if there were to be a positive development, Trump himself and all of his supporters will take care of making sure people know about it. Like, I don't feel like we're going to have to work hard to get that word out. I think really our focus is on documenting the events that the administration and Trump himself are trying to twist or alter or skew to their favor.
So this seems like a pretty big endeavor for basically for volunteers, and you have a full-time job. I'm sure this is taking up a lot of your time. How do you justify this time personally? Like, why is this important for you to do?
It's such a hard thing to answer. The first person that I talked to about the project was my wife, because I realized that if I were going to do this, it would take a lot of time. And so that would take me away from my family time. I have my wife and I have three kids. I love to spend time with them. And I've always, as in my working life, tried to keep a very clear boundary between my work time and my family time, and keep that family time set aside. And since this was going to come out of that, I needed to sort of run that by her and see what she thought. And she asked me the question, do you want to do this or do you feel compelled to do this? And after thinking about it, I said, I think I feel compelled to do it. Like, this isn't something necessarily that I even want to be doing. Like, I don't relish the idea of spending 4 years, you know, spending my nights and weekends trying to document facts as they unfold, when, you know, everybody should be doing that, and that shouldn't be a question. But that said, I think we're living in a reality where there are people resistant to facts and who are trying very, very hard to put out accounts of things that have happened that are counter to fact. And so I feel compelled to try and do my part to call out if the emperor isn't wearing any clothes. I want to say he's not wearing any clothes. And I think a lot of the people on the project feel similarly.
That was Jan Miksovsky. He runs Presterity in his spare time. Check it out for yourself. We're tweeting out a link to Presterity now. Coming this weekend to downtown Seattle, people dressed like comic book characters. They'll be here by the thousands for SakuraCon, the Pacific Northwest's oldest and biggest convention for fans of all things anime, gaming, and Asian culture. It's happening at the Washington State Convention Center. And for sure, some of those people will say they're more than fans. They're super fans. Zoe Fraud-Blanar and Aaron Glazer have spent a lot of time thinking about how a fan levels up to a super fan. They're co-authors of the book Super Fandom: How Our Obsessions Are Changing What We Buy and Who We Are. And they found being a super fan requires more of you than just liking something.
Being a fan is active. It's not a thing that someone is. It's a thing that they do. It's something that they can participate in actively and help to contribute to what makes that thing a better fan object.
We talk about fandom as performative, that you can't be a fan alone or in isolation. If you are a consumer of, say, Harry Potter, you may sit at home and read the books. But to actively be a fan, you need to go see the Harry Potter theme parks, or go talk to other people about Harry Potter and express which house you would get sorted into, or go stand and wait in line for the new release. That's a fan, and it requires being active and actually fanning on behalf of your fan object, as opposed to just being a really enthusiastic consumer who might read all the books and then watch all the movies and take notes for yourself, but not really do that in the company of other people.
It sounds like not every consumer is a fan. That's clear. But can you be a fan without being a consumer? Meaning, can you be a fan without the spending money part of it?
Strangely enough, you actually can. Fans and consumers do often have a lot of overlap, but they don't have to. That's the nice thing about having so many of these different, we call them the fan-like activities, different ways that people can show their love and devotion and their status within a fan community. It's true that maybe forming a collection could require some money, but other things might not. Things like traveling or dressing up, as that fan object, if it's a celebrity, things like helping others to find the fandom and answer questions. These are all things that can be done for free. And certainly in many contexts, it would be impossible to be a consumer of that fan object. For example, fans of DeLorean cars, there are only a certain number of them in existence. Most people who are fans of those will maybe even never even see one in person, much less own one.
Well, you've brought up a couple of different examples of kinds of fans, right? Aaron, you talked about Harry Potter fans. We just talked a little bit about DeLorean fans as well, Zoe. But are all fans the same? I guess I'm thinking about what fandom looks like here in Seattle. And we have fans of the Seattle Seahawks, but we also have fans of the Star Wars franchise. So if it's just the actions you're describing that make someone a fan, and if those two groups came together, what they would have to talk about?
Fans, in a way, can actually be thought of as the same. Often when we differentiate in our heads between, say, a sports fan and a comics fan, both of which Seattle has plenty of, we think of them as these two very distinct groups of people. We think sports fan, that's socially acceptable. Being a comics fan, may or may not be. The real difference between groups like that is usually actually external. It's the stigma that people place those groups under. It has much more to do with how people think of those social groups and whether or not they would actually want to be associated with them than anything about the actual thing that they're a fan of. In terms of the activities, both groups actually do very similar things. They both go to conventions, whether that's in an arena or, at a convention center or a hotel. They both dress up in special costumes, whether that's a jersey or dressing up like, Spider-Man. They both collect things, whether it's sports memorabilia or figurines. So we're seeing very, very similar behaviors. It's just that society is okay with one and not so okay with the other sometimes.
I brought up an example of Seattle Seahawks super fans. They dress up in special costumes, as you said. They may have collections. They travel. They do all these other things to support their love of the Seahawks. But did you, in writing this book and doing this research, is there anything unique about the way Seattle does super fandom?
Well, I think super fandom is fairly universal in a sense of how people actually perform it. But there's a lot of things that Seattle have that people become super fans of. And Seattle, and especially giving your location, giving some of the more interesting companies that have been founded there, has a lot of sites where people come and we do pilgrimages to. So one of my favorites is Starbucks and Pike Place Marketplace, because it's actually the foundation of this global enterprise that people love. I mean, people love their pumpkin spice lattes, and they actually will take pilgrimages and write about going to see the original Starbucks, even if it's not the original Starbucks and is the second one. But they make an effort to seek out that location so that they can experience this thing they love in kind of this location that means a lot to them and that they internalize a lot.
That's interesting. So Seattle is unique, you're saying, because it has a lot of, I guess, sacred sites for super fans, like that Starbucks in Pike Place, for example.
Sacred actually is a great way of putting it. Pilgrimage is actually a term that comes from religion. People have been taking pilgrimages for probably as long as there's been culture. So it makes sense that this is something which people feel close to, not necessarily because it's pretty or because it has economic value, but just because of the feeling and the sacredness of what they feel when they go there. And Seattle actually has a number of sites like that.
I mean, one of the things I think interesting about Seattle is a lot when we in the book, we talk about how fandom in a lot of ways is losing its stigma as we get further along in this century, largely because of the rise of the internet and kind of the rise of the tech star. And with Microsoft and all of the large tech industry there, I think Seattle got there a little bit faster than everyone else did. There is a convention in Seattle that was started in 2004 called PAX, which was originally the Penny Arcade Expo, which was, as far as I know at that time, the only gaming expo in the world. You had things like San Diego Comic Con that did comics and pop culture. But the people who founded PAX really wanted something oriented around gaming in itself to celebrate this thing they loved. And gaming, still in the early 2000s, had a decent amount of stigma around to it. The people who sat at home and played video games and board games kind of were looked at a little bit like the comics fans were, where they were, you know, playing on their Xbox and not really socializing. And this event started with 3,000 people and has since grown to 70,000 and 5 different conventions that happen around the world every year, all origin in Seattle. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the tech industry reduced a lot of the stigma around those types of things, perhaps in Seattle sooner than elsewhere, and certainly definitely than the middle of the country.
You have both brought up the word stigma when it comes to fandom, that there is still a little stigma associated with being a super fan of different kinds of things. So I'm sure that there is someone listening to this who is thinking, why should I care about fans? Why should I care about super fans? What do you want people who don't have this relationship with a fan object to take away from the benefits, I guess, of fandom?
A lot of the traditional organizing institutions that we used to count on for coming together as groups, things like, the local religion, the local government, immediate family groups, all of these obviously are still important in the modern day, but we're finding that modern people within the last 150 years, say, have started realizing that all of these institutions can be infallible. Our parents aren't always correct about everything. The place that we grew up isn't necessarily the place we want to live the rest of our lives. And as these organizations maybe dim a little bit in importance, we need other things to bring us together as a group. We need other ways to answer these important questions of who am I? Where do I belong in this world? How should I be behaving? How can I meet other people like myself? And thank goodness we have pop culture to fill in some of these questions for us, right? Because no one wants to live a life of existential dread. We're all looking for answers at any given moment. And the nice thing about pieces of pop culture, these things that now we use to make fan groups out of, is they can answer those questions too. It's true that something like the Bible has, you know, examples of how people could act, but so does Harry Potter, and certainly so does something like Star Wars. And for people who are looking for that, that's very important too.
Zoe Fraud-Blanar and Aaron Glazer. They're the co-authors of the book Super Fandom, How Our Obsessions Are Changing What We Buy and Who We Are. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. Thanks so much for listening. BBC News coming up next.